As Dan Shore mentioned, the economy gained 162,000 jobs in March, according to the U.S. Labor Department, the most significant growth in 3 years. But the unemployment rate held steady at 9.7%, which is still high by just about any measure. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
This is the jobs report, where the labor market turned the corner, according to a lot of economist types, where sustained job losses are replaced with sustained job creation.
This number was the big number that everybody was looking for this week.
Carl Mills is the chief investment officer with Jerica Mills and Kiefer.
It's in the right direction, and that should be good.
It's encouraging, but not super encouraging.
That not-so-glowing assessment comes from John English. He's not an economist. Until this week, he was unemployed.
This is my fifth day now.
English had been unemployed since January, when the Fresno Metropolitan Museum, where he worked, was forced to shut down.
I'm employed again. A couple of my friends this past month or so have become employed again. And, you know, it seems to be turning around, but very slowly.
He says that uneasy feeling he had when he was looking for work is still coloring his financial decisions. Gary Francis isn't celebrating the jobs report either.
I try not to look too much. It's kind of like looking at the 401k numbers. You just kind of ignore it and reduces your stress a little.
Francis has spent most of his career in manufacturing, working as a mechanical engineer. That is, until a little more than a year ago, when he was laid off.
The other day was the first time I actually got a response from any job that I had applied for in pretty much that entire time.
One fairly positive government jobs report can't undo 100 job applications that went nowhere. Frustration is entirely normal, says job search expert Rick Gillis.
There is a very real job search fatigue that sets in. It's a lot of work to find a job, and then, of course, there's all the stresses of normal life going on, and you don't have an income to address those stresses.
Most people focus on the unemployment rate, which is currently 9.7%. But Gillis looks at something else, underemployment, and that's near 17%. Richard Curtin is the director of surveys of consumers at the University of Michigan. He says there's plenty of bad hiding in the latest employment numbers.
Long-term unemployment increased. Working part-time because you can't find full-time work or more hours has increased. And so the pain of unemployment still persists.
He says the consumers he surveyed have been expecting a positive shift for some time now. But the improvements are still small compared to the massive job losses over the last 2 years. And to keep pointing out the negative just a little bit longer, more than half of the 162,000 jobs created in March were temporary. Aileen Heinberg is a psychologist who specializes in financial decision-making at the Rand Corporation. She says temporary and part-time work don't fill the void created by a job loss.
When you look at the outcomes and sort of the psychological well-being of people who have to take these kind of jobs, they look a lot more like people who are unemployed than people who are really in the jobs they would normally be having.
There's another reason this, the most positive jobs report in 3 years, isn't likely to cause rampant good feelings and free spending. It's something behavioral economists talk about. Losses loom larger than gains. Or in other words, the bad news of a 9.7% unemployment rate counts more than the good news that the economy created 162,000 jobs. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News.
In 1981, Clash of the Titans blended Greek mythology with time-honored special effects, the latter provided by the master of stop-motion animation, Ray Harryhausen. But today, technological advances make that movie look quaint. So Hollywood's having another go. Bob Mondello says in the new Clash of the Titans, the effects are indeed special, but that's not always a good thing.
These days, when a story is as old as time, we ask that our effects be up to the minute.
Release the Kraken!
Digitized monsters emerging from the briny deep as orchestras thunder and cameras swoop in three dimensions, even if the 3D has to be grafted on after the fact, as it is here. But it wasn't always like that. Back in 1981, which was, remember, 4 years after Star Wars came out, the notion was that a classic story called for classic everything. So, in addition to the stop-motion effects that Ray Harryhausen had been perfecting for some four decades, the original Clash of the Titans had an all-purpose sword and sandals script, mortals offending and then having to fight with the gods, and an Olympus populated by gods of the British stage, headed by Laurence Olivier, whose Zeus was pretty literally acting up a storm.
I command you to let loose the last of the Titans. Let loose the Kraken! The kingdom of Acrisius must be destroyed.
All very impressive in its stately way, a little ballast for the rather silly action sequences where Harry Hamlin's Perseus would be engaging in pitched battles with a slew of jerky but persuasively physical monsters. The new Clash largely does away with the stately stuff in favor of more clashing. Clashing accents, for instance, between Liam Neeson's Irish Zeus and Sam Worthington's Australian Perseus.
Your blood is mine, Perseus, and that makes you a god.
I'd rather die in the mud with those men than live forever as a god.
You foolish boy.
Also clashing acting styles, since Perseus is now something of a martial arts expert, and of course the digital clashing you've come for. Battles with giant scorpions now go on for days. Medusa does her slithering not in a torchlit temple, but high above a fiery pit of molten lava. Everything's bigger and louder and faster, and if much of the action is therefore incoherent, the crowd that loves Transformers is going to be cool enough with that. They may be less cool with the fact that shelling out an extra couple of bucks to see Clash of the Titans in 3D actually makes the experience less enjoyable. The film was shot in 2D, then digitally altered to push the foreground stuff further forward. And the effect is pretty strange, sort of like a pop-up book. In other words, though the whole rationale for remaking Clash of the Titans was that 29 years of technological improvements meant it could now be more realistic, by backing into a technology that suddenly got trendy again, 3D, the producers essentially undo that advantage and make the film look artificial again. The gods are no doubt amused. I'm Bob Mondello.
Of course, Major League Baseball season opens tomorrow. Tim Wendle's in our studios. He's a founding editor of USA Today Baseball Weekly. He has a new book out in which he tries to explain and explore the heater, the Ilbrie bullet, the cheddar pellet, the fastball. The book is called High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. Tim, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Scott. You got quite a few of those good nicknames in there.
Yeah, thanks very much, yeah. How do you throw a great fastball?
You throw a great fastball, first of all, being blessed with the gift of being able to throw a great fastball. And I think often we tend to see these kids coming up, age 11, 15, 16, oh, they got it made. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it is being able to control the fastball and being able to use it to your own devices. And at least half the folks we looked at in High Heat were cursed by it. I think if somebody came along and said, would you like to do without this? It would go, yes, please. Yeah. And even people like Nolan Ryan, et cetera, you know, had to make something out of it.
How fast can a human arm, and it's not just the arm, mm-hmm. throw a fastball?
It looks like we can top end out at roughly about 107 to 109 miles per hour. And unlike other sports, Scott, it seems like that's relatively the barrier.
Yeah.
It's almost like the sound barrier a little bit.
Now, see, that's remarkable because we tell ourselves with better training, diet, nutrition, kinesiology, acupuncture, chiropractic, and I'm not even going to mention steroids.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. Well, I've just mentioned it. That obviously this has to make people perform better, but there does seem to be a limit on the fastball.
There's a limit on the fastball, it appears, and also, unlike other sports, say if I'm a basketball player, well, sure, it makes a lot more sense to be tall. If I'm a football player, it makes sense to be muscular or bulky or whatever it would be. You line up all the great fastballers, fireballers throughout history, and there's no correlation really between size and height and weight.
God bless you, Tim. You don't shy away from coming across with the goods, a list of the top 10 fastballers of all time. We're not going to disclose the whole list, but I want to ask you about some people on the list,
sure,
if I might. Man you mentioned, number five. Sandy Koufax,
mm-hmm,
began with the then Brooklyn Dodgers. Obviously, they went to L.A. And for 11 years from the mid-50s to the mid-60s, he was almost unhittable.
Yes.
Koufax into his windup and the 1-2 pitch. Fastball, foul, back out of play. 2-2, the count to Chris Cruz. Sandy reading signs into his windup, 2-2 pitch. Fastball got him swinging.
As you averred, this was a guy who had some problems taming his fire at one point.
And I think this is something that all of us can gain something from, this legacy, this brotherhood of fireballers. We tend to put them up on pedestals, but they're all ones who had to come to grips with this gift. You know, are they going to turn into a blessing or a curse? Koufax really had bookend careers. He had the journeyman career. Literally turned it around in less than 2 weeks in spring training one time and suddenly became the Hall of Fame guy that he became. And I always find Koufax's story, and somewhat some of the others, heartening in a way. Mm-hmm. Okay, they were blessed with this amazing talent, but they still struggled and had to find their way through too.
He just as easily could have been someone like Kerry Wood or Mark Pryor.
Sure. Or he could have been certainly, say, Steve Delkowski.
Steve Delkowski played mid-50s to mid-60s, Kingsport, Knoxville, Aberdeen, Elmira, Stockton, number two on your list. And he never got to the major leagues?
Never. The day, Scott, he was fitted for a uniform, he threw out his arm that afternoon in a spring training game and had one of the more star-crossed, not just careers, yeah, but really lives. Ended up being alcoholic migrant worker out in California, ended up being homeless, then was brought back to his hometown, New Britain, Connecticut, and he's really regained a sense of himself. He's regained, I think, you know, significant portions of his just confidence and such. He's one of those guys where it's great. You can go home again. If you're going to go to New Britain, Connecticut, he's as big a star in his own way as he was when he was striking out 17, 18 in high school.
You've got a name on the list at number seven, who I would call, I would not hesitate to call the greatest pitcher of all time. I just didn't quite know until reading your book that he threw one of the fastest pitches of all time. Satchel Paige.
Yeah. Well, Satchel, you know, because of the color barrier at that point in sports and such, I mean, we never saw, at least mainstream America, the media, never saw Satchel Paige at his best.
He was 42 when he came up with the Cleveland Indians. He was a rookie.
Right.
At least 42, I suppose we should always say when we talk about Satchel Paige. And so his days as a fireballer might have been he was winning on a lot of curves and guile.
Yeah, but he still had, you know, a substantial curve fireball, but certainly not once was. And he's also one of those interesting guys. All of them, they hit the crossroads either mentally or injury wise or whatever. And he went through a stretch where he was actually playing first base in the Negro Leagues because his arm had gone south, and suddenly, miraculously, he came back and then made the majors.
Does the fastball play a larger or smaller role in the game today?
I think it plays me a smaller role, and because of that, the search for it has become even more pronounced. Because mm-hmm. we've seen how, you know, we're on the eve of a new baseball season, how quickly teams can turn themselves around with a prominent fireballer or two. I mean, the Red Sox win again a couple years back with Papelbon in the bullpen. The Detroit Tigers take off with some power arms like Justin Verlander and Joel Zamaya. So again, I think maybe there's less great quality arms, and because of that, there's more of a race to get them. And I think some of the real interest as this season begins is Steven Strasburg, potentially when's he going to premiere here in Washington, and also this Cuban defector, Adorado Chapman down in Cincinnati. He seems to be throwing 100, 203. Two teams that are looking for help in a big way, and think they may have it with suddenly a young kid who can throw hard.
Tim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.
Tim Wendel, his new book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. It does have a number one on the list, but you got to get the book to find out what that is. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Early in Roxana Sabiri's 100 days in an Iranian prison, she used the bottom edge of a toothpaste tube to etch a phrase into the heater of her cell. Roxana, what did you write?
I wrote, "God save Iran."
And why that phrase?
Well, I wanted to add at the end of that phrase, "from these people." I meant those kinds of people who had put me in prison that day.
Roxana Sabiri, of course, joins us from our studios in New York. She's written a memoir of her time in Iran's notorious Evin prison, where she was held on charges of espionage. While an international movement of human rights groups, governments, news organizations, including this one, NPR, and concerned citizens, including many of our listeners, called for her release, Roxana Sabiri's book is called Between Two Worlds, My Life and Captivity in Iran. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It feels good to have finished the book and have been able to tell some of the stories of my cellmates and also what happened to me in Evin prison.
You were locked up with a group of people you came to admire and love.
Yes. At first I was in solitary confinement for 2 weeks, and then I was taken out of solitary confinement and put in another cell where there were two women, Mahfash and Faribah. They are two of the seven leaders of the minority Baha'i community. It's thought to be the largest non-Muslim religion in Iran. And they're still in prison today. When I had first met them, I was surprised. I didn't know how people could have survived so long in one little cell. Mahfash had been in solitary confinement for 6 months, and I'd been going crazy after 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And Faribah had been in solitary confinement for 4 months, and they had not seen their lawyers yet. And from them, I learned many lessons of strength. They were pressured to make false confessions about themselves, but they wouldn't agree to do it, even though they probably could have been freed that way.
I want to make it plain that in your account, you were not physically tortured, but you were blindfolded and interrogated, and your interrogator said to you, "Look, we have agents all over the world. We can get to your family. And then if you talk about what happened here," your interrogator said, "I will personally sign your death warrant." That's not just idle talk when they say that to someone in prison who's locked up and blindfolded.
No, and I knew what had happened in Evin prison before. I knew the history. Many political prisoners are held there. Have been held there. Zahra Kazemi, the Iranian-Canadian journalist, had been detained there in 2003, and she died mysteriously there. I knew there were hangings there. I knew that no one knew where I was. I knew that if they wanted, they could do whatever they want with me and pretend that they had never heard of what happened to me.
But why, to put it into a convenient wax ball for people, why did you confess? Why did you recant?
I confess for a few reasons. One was, and of course it was a false confession, I was afraid that if I didn't cooperate, as they said, that who knew what would happen to me. They told me you could be here for 10 years or 20 years until you're an old lady. And I also knew how things worked in Iran. Oftentimes people are forced to make confessions, and I had seen on television televised confessions of dual nationals before me and British sailors who had been detained in 2006. And after they were released, after making these confessions, some of them had recanted their statements. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm just going to do the same thing. I'm going to make this false confession. I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to recant everything. And sorry, you asked why I recanted?
Yeah. You recanted in prison.
Yes, I did. I couldn't take it anymore. I was, from the moment I made that false confession, I was very ashamed of myself. I was much weaker than I thought I would be if I was ever under pressure. So this feeling, along with meeting other women in prison, my cellmates, whom I saw, had not buckled under the same pressures. They inspired me. They didn't tell me what to do, but I decided to recant.
I want to ask you a question in your capacity as an expert on Iranian affairs, an expert through hard experience on Iranian affairs. Reports this week that the Iranian government wants to build more nuclear enrichment sites in the country in defiance of the UN. So is this regime reckless, dangerous, impossible to trust?
It's not a very transparent regime so that we know who's really making decisions, or maybe there are many factions and many players making decisions. But I do believe that we have to keep an avenue for negotiations open. But human rights always, I believe, has to be a first-tier issue along with the nuclear issue. Like one of my cellmates, Mafash, told me, Roxana, when you go back to America, please tell others that our country is not only about the nuclear issue, it's also about people like us.
You're back home in Fargo.
Yes.
For the moment.
Yes.
I have to ask. So in the middle of the night or the middle of the day, do you ever think about that interrogator that said to you, we have people all over the world, we can find your family?
Usually at night. Sometimes in my dreams, especially the past two nights, I don't know why, and I hope my dreams mean nothing. You know, I don't hate those people. Although I hate what they did to me, it doesn't mean I hate them. And when I speak out like this about what happened to me and the violations of human rights of my cellmates and so many people today who are still there, it's with the hope that they'll change their behaviors, maybe that I can add to other voices pushing for change there.
Roxana, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Roxana Sabiri, your new book, Between Two Worlds, My Life in Captivity in Iran. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
The Vatican has also been on the defensive with the media. It's denounced the New York Times, among others, for pursuing stories that suggest church officials, including the Pope, failed to act against priests credibly accused of abuse. But no paper has covered sexual abuse within the church longer than the National Catholic Reporter. Now, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the paper has published an editorial questioning the Pope's credibility.
It's a small, independent, not-for-profit newspaper based in Kansas City, Missouri, with just 8 full-time news staffers and 34,000 subscribers. Joe Feuerherd is the paper's publisher.
NCR was founded about 45 years ago to report on the news of the church like a good local or good city newspaper covers the news of its municipality.
From its founding, the National Catholic Reporter embraced a liberalism inspired by the reforms of the Vatican II Council. Kenneth Woodward contributed articles in the early days. He went on to be the longtime religion editor of Newsweek magazine.
This was a novelty. Most of the papers were owned by bishops. And they were house organs. These people did independent reporting, and they did it right from the start with high journalistic standards. And it was pretty exciting.
Its best-known reporter may be the ubiquitous John Allen Jr., a respected authority on Vatican doctrine and politics who's become the paper's public face. But the National Catholic Reporter assigns correspondents and freelancers to travel across the country and across the world to chronicle good deeds and success stories, as well as the tensions within the church. One story has always been different.
Beginning in 1985, we started to see reports of victims of clergy abuse, whose parents were eventually going to a court to take on the church after approaching bishops and priests and not getting any satisfaction from their complaints.
Thomas Fox is the paper's top editor. He says a pattern soon emerged.
The two parts of this, one was the clergy abuse, and the second was the cover-up of the local bishop. And that usually went with the bishop denying that the abuse ever took place, and then often turning on the victim, saying that that person was just making it up.
Fox says reporters often found that priests were shuffled to other parishes and complaints of abuse would recur. Even back then, the National Catholic Reporter called for full accountability from the church. The coverage created a backlash.
We were getting letters from bishops. We were getting letters from priests and letters to the editor who were saying at that time that we were really destroying the church. And it was a very, very lonely and very difficult period for us.
Now, after episodic eruptions, the issue has once again surfaced with a vengeance in Ireland, Germany, the U.S., and Italy, and it has reached inside the Vatican itself. Last week, the National Catholic Reporter published a new editorial that starts tough and only gets tougher.
The focus now is on Benedict. What did he know? When did he know it? How did he act once he knew?
That's publisher Joe Feuerherd reading the editorial he wrote with Tom Fox.
The strategies employed so far, taking the legal path, obscuring the truth, have failed miserably. We now have the largest institutional crisis in centuries, possibly in church history. It is time, past time really, for direct answers to difficult questions. It is time to tell the truth.
I asked Fox if he and Feuerherd were aware of the weight of their words in that most recent editorial. Here's part of our interview.
And yet the language reminds me of Watergate. What did he know? When did he know it? How did he act once he knew? Right? I mean, it's talking about the credibility, the ability of the Pope to lead the church, right?
I think that's correct. And these are not just questions that we're asking. These are questions that Catholics around the world are asking.
This time around, the Catholic journalists with dual mandates of faith and truth-telling say they've received few outraged protests for their coverage. Instead, Fox says, they get letters from people who say they have also been abused. And they ask, can you tell our story as well? David Folkenflik, NPR News.